Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to Auto Transport Intel. It is Wednesday. It is noon Central Time. That means it's time for DOT compliance with your DOT guy, Brian Riker. And he wants to help you. He wants to give you advice, but we'll ride the line of legality because this gets very legal. You know this. If you've been put out of service, this show's for you. If you have DOT questions, IFTA, IRP, clearinghouse, do you have clearinghouse questions? Are you saying to yourself, what's a clearinghouse? You need this show. I'm telling you, protect your CDL, right? Did that get someone's attention? Do me a favor, I'll tell you what. If you know somebody that needs help protecting their CDL, first, leave a like. Thank you so much. Then click share. It's right below the video. Click share. Click copy. Grab that YouTube link. Text it, email it, share it on social media. There's plenty of places to get, Fuel Island advice of, you know, where there's a bunch of money and all this stuff. But who talks about the legality of the DOT? Well, obviously, I know there's information out there for that as well. But on this show, this is where you can get the best advice outside of hiring a consultant. In fact, you can hire a consultant. Go to autotransportintel.com, click on sign up, become an ATI insider, and find out how you can tap into our network of experts. Speaking of, it's time to go to Brian. Oh, and do jump in the live chat. Two Bears, thanks so much. We're going to get to that question. Brian, can you see me and hear me okay?
Yes, I can, Jay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We're back, and here, we got a question right out of the box. Let's do this. David asks, what's up with the red flag on the back of the trailer below the back car on top? Is it necessary?
Great question, Dave. And it used to be required to flag your overhang. And some states even had differing laws where you could do it with one or you were required to do it with two flags. Since I want to say 2016 or 18, there has been a change in that. OEM manufacturers complained about new cars getting scratched from the flag. And 2015, when we did the FAST Act that allowed the 80-foot stinger, they removed the flagging requirement from new cars. Some folks have taken this to mean that there's no flagging requirement for any car. Others have taken it to mean that if it's not a brand new vehicle that you're transporting, it needs a flag. I don't have an exact answer for you on that. I have not seen a citation in years for not having a flag on a true automobile transporter. Now, if your truck doesn't meet the definition of an automobile transporter, then this exception does not apply to you, and you have to flag it under whatever the state laws are, just like it was a flatbed hauling a load of steel or pipe or anything like that.
Oh, there we go. Mic check. If you're new here, just like me, then I want you to feel welcome to ask a question. This is Brian Riker. He's your DOT guy. Brian, you have a company. Tell us a little bit more about you and your company and what you do.
Happy to, Jay. I own a compliance consulting company. We're called Fleet Compliance Solutions. You can find me on the web at www.yourdotguy.com. That's yourdotguy.com. I've had Fleet Compliance Solutions for 12 years. It was born as a sister company to the fleet of tow trucks and car haulers that we operated. And I was finding a lot of companies were coming to me and asking questions. So we started this compliance consulting company. I've been doing the consulting pretty much full time for 5 years now, have not owned a truck since 2018. That said, I say that I am not just a talking head. I am a practitioner. I am out there on the road alongside of you folks every week. I just went down to Jacksonville Monday and drove a car hauler up from TNC Fabrication down there to bring it up to New Jersey. So I am dealing with the same issues you are. just not nearly as often anymore. So I hold a valid Class A license. I've been doing this about 31 years now, and I just want to give back to the industry that's given me and my family so much, and that's what we do at Fleet Compliance Solutions, is we give back to you, let you learn from the painful lessons that myself and clients before you have already learned dealing with the DOT. I almost forgot. I'm a member of the Illinois Truck Enforcement Association and the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance, which CVSA are the groups that train the motor carrier enforcement officers all throughout North America. Along with some other trade associations, the Independent Automobile Transporters Alliance, IATA, the Towing and Recovery Association of America, Pennsylvania Towing Association, Southwest Tow Operators, and the Towing and Recovery Association of Ohio. So I get around, I do advocacy work on behalf of non-traditional fleets such as car haulers and tow trucks and landscapers, and I'm here to help.
And we invite you, where is it, to stump Brian. Bring your questions. If you got, you think you've got it, you finally have that question that Brian can't answer, well, we bet, actually, David doubles down and bets. He stands on a stump and he bets that you can't stump Brian. Let's do this. I got some things here. Here's one. I saw this. I don't know if this is a stumper, but someone just attempted to freight jack me, I think. I think I saw this on Twitter. Car came up alongside after I passed him. He held up a sign saying, you should get off at the next exit. Your tire is flat. I didn't feel anything. My inflation light was on. What do you think?
It happens. Definitely happens. Some people are trying to be good Samaritans when they think they see something is wrong. That said, you probably did the right thing in today's day and age. Now, I wouldn't count on your inflation light always being accurate, and I hope you did stop eventually once you were away from that vehicle and double-checked your tires. So my question would be, did you find a flat tire or did you not? So if you didn't find a flat tire, I think someone was messing with you and could have possibly been trying to hijack your truck or your load or just plain rob you. Sadly, it does happen.
What I found most interesting about this is it made me think, okay, yeah, note to self. Next time someone passes me with a sign, don't do it, right?
My advice would be, look in your mirrors real closely, see if you can actually see a defect that they're trying to identify. And if you're not sure, it's okay to get off the next exit, but pull into a well-lit public place with a lot of people around and make sure you're parked, like pull right up to the fuel island or something, but don't park where you're blocked in case it goes bad real quick. But just make sure there's people around. They're less likely to follow you into a truck stop or a shopping mall as they would be just off the end of an unlit exit ramp with no services.
Because who's driving down the road and says, hey, do me a favor, reach in the back seat. I got some cardboard back there and a Sharpie. Do me a favor, make a sign real quick. This dude's got a flat tire. I've never heard of it. So it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Let's go to the next question. Danny B. I have uneven all tire wear on my trailer. Can I be put out of service?
Uneven, no, provided that the tires are still in acceptable condition. So trailer tires must have a minimum of 230 seconds of tread. You cannot go below 230 seconds of tread on two adjacent tread tracks in the tire. Can't have any steel showing. Can't have any bulges or cuts in the sidewall. It doesn't matter if the tires are wearing uneven or if they're choppy, as long as they're not below that 230 seconds of an inch threshold. Now, that will probably indicate you have some other issues, maybe wrong inflation pressure, maybe shocks or airbags going bad, depending upon the type of suspension you have on your trailer, or you do a lot of empty miles. It's really hard to get your tires to wear even when you are deadheading more than 50% or close to 50% of your time. The tires are designed to wear best with a load on them. these trailers just aren't heavy enough to keep the tires in firm contact with the road. So hopefully that gives you something to look at.
Well, I'm going to do a follow-up. So what do you think, Danny B should do about it? Go somewhere, see somebody?
Yes, you should have somebody check the suspension on your trailer. You should check with your trailer manufacturer to see what they recommend for inflation pressure on your trailer. You'll find that they actually have different recommendations for whether you're loaded, partially loaded, or empty. And I'm not saying anybody adjusts their tire pressure every time they get unloaded with the trailer. But that said, don't just presume that 95 or 100 or 105 PSI is right, or don't make the mistake of just inflating it to the maximum pressure on the sidewall of the tire. Your trailer will have a recommended inflation pressure for its intended use, and that's what they have found works best to give you the weight capacity as well as tire wear. But talk to a tire shop, see what they can tell you about it. Likely you're going to find it's inflation, suspension, or just you do an awful lot of deadhead right now.
As you know, getting into anything in trucking is a lot more than just the load itself. And so on DOT compliance, we cover a lot of that minutia that just isn't as exciting to cover, but is so necessary. Let's go to another one here, Brian. We've got, we're going to go into how we doing. Oh, brother. I say it that way because I have the worst video to share. I shared this last night, and I'm going to do it again today. Mic check, 1, 2, 3. Okay, here we go. Are you ready for this?
I am ready.
Oh, man.
I've seen this one.
Oh, no. This is awful.
It is. Fortunately, this one had no reported major injuries. Two people on the train had minor non-life-threatening injuries.
Wow. Well, so I discovered? You see my mouse?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the driver right here.
That may very well be. I think, and if it is, he's doing what you're supposed to when you're stuck on a track. You get out of your vehicle and you go upstream of the direction of the train so that the debris does not hit you. Mm. There's some excellent information on this published by the Federal Railway Administration and the American Railway Association called Operation Lifesaver. It tells you what to do to avoid getting stuck and hit by a train, and it tells you what to do if you are high centered on the tracks. And so you might want to check out Operation Lifesaver. It could very well save your life. This is unfortunate. For those of you in podcast land, we have a high mount, fully loaded 8 or 9 car trailer that is stuck on a grade level railroad crossing. And you can see from way back here from the dash cam of the vehicle behind them, this car hauler never should have attempted to make this railroad crossing. You can see just how steep of a grade that is. I don't know what the driver was thinking. Don't know what happened, but
thank you. That's why I'm sharing it. So I got kind of stumped last night when I showed this, and I wanted to explain why. Thank you. Number one, I do believe that an experienced car hauler would not have attempted to get over this lip. We've all seen this. You can jump this thing. In fact, I know. Wow, that just went through my mind. I remember when I was in high school, and I was with some friends, and yeah, the guy was like, yeah, we're going to jump it. That's how steep it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now, I don't know, because I have not spoken to the driver in this particular video, I don't know if his trailer was equipped with an overinflate. That is an option that should be required on all car haulers that are low ground clearance. It allows you to overinflate your airbags, and you get another 4 to 6, sometimes even more, in inches of ground clearance and lift. That may have been enough to get him unstuck from this tracks.
Right.
I don't know.
He was literally teetering, right? He couldn't get off.
He's hung up just past his rear drives of the tractor on the front of the trailer, probably right on the first rail of the track. And I don't know how long he's been there. heads up, you don't want to mess around on a railroad track. If you're stuck, your first call is to the phone number on those crossing guards. Tell them you have a vehicle stuck on the track. It'll identify the crossing and the phone number of who to call so that they can stop the train traffic. Don't count on the train traffic being stopped. That said, in a situation like this, I would have crawled under the front of the under the back of that tractor if the train wasn't coming, and pulled the leveling valve rod off of my airbags, super overinflated my airbags on the tractor, and tried to back up off the crossing. It might have given you enough clearance to get out of there. But the first step is get out of the truck, get the people away from the truck, and call the number on that crossing. This one is kind of sad because it didn't have to happen. And fortunately, there were no serious injuries from this crash that I'm aware of.
Right. Well, and we don't know. So we don't know how long he's been there. We don't know how much experience he has. We don't know who was telling him you're running late. Because look, is it dusk? You got to get this thing delivered today, you know. We've already told you we'd give you an extra $20. I mean, it just, the whole thing just reeks of, okay. All right, I'm just going to play it. Here we go.
Go ready? For it. Yeah, that one is horrible.
There he is, trying to get the attention of the train.
Yeah, now I don't know how long he's been there, but he's nowhere near far enough down the track. If you follow the advice from the American Railway Association, you need to get at least a mile down the track.
Well, you're right. I mean, he's lucky he didn't get hurt. That's true. Yes. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, he's very close to being injured
right there.
Yeah.
And it just, so I want to finish. It really concerns me that the amount of pressure that gets put, you need to get there, what are you doing, to the amount of lack of compensation. You know, speaking of that, on the everything's shortage and people shortage, and are the rates going up in auto transport? I don't think so. Not that I know of.
No, and with there being a lack of freight for car haulers to haul right now, I wouldn't be surprised if we see the rates stagnate or even drop as carriers get desperate to keep their truck moving to pay the bills. The easy work is not there right now just because of a lack of vehicles to move. So I would not be surprised to see rate stagnation at best.
Devin, he says he sent you an email and he needs your help. Okay, so, and I had shared the onair@yourdotguy.com. If you need Brian's help, send him an email. onair@yourdotguy.com. That's the fastest way to get a hold of Brian. Also, do me a favor, just as someone sent me an email about the train, send me the news. Send it to autotransportintel@gmail.com. We'll share it. We'll talk about it. And let's go to the next thing. Let's do that. Let's see here. We've got... will you start a trucking company with me? Now, I realize, camera one, this one's not funny to everybody. And it's not meant to be funny. It's meant to get your attention because if you are starting a trucking company, I mean, you are starting a new marriage. Am I wrong?
Not at all, especially when you have a partner involved in it. But even by yourself, it's not something to be taken lightly.
Yeah, no, it's a big deal. So here's one I just got on YouTube. Can I lease on with you? That's all I got.
Okay. They were asking you if they could lease on with you.
Yes.
I didn't know you had lease operator broadcast
either.
Personalities.
And what if I'm horrible to work with? I mean, what?
I'm not making fun of this, but this question happens a lot.
And it does. So let's talk about why. Why does this, what's going on here?
It, I'm going to say a lot of it comes from people that just aren't doing their homework. They're looking for the easy way into the business, or they thought they had it all figured out and found out it's not as easy as they thought it was. And now they're trying to not lose their truck and trailer and their house and destroy their credit. And they're willing to lease on or take anything they can get for someone to provide work and loads for them. Right now, we're going to see a lot of that because, like I said, the freight volume just is not there for cars at the moment. But yeah, a one-line question like that, I need a lot more information to even know if I could help you, buddy.
So, okay, so let's do this, because I always like to follow up with, all right, let's say we have a program. All right. Does somebody already have a program? I mean, what would be good advice for Jay here? What can we offer Jay? Go talk to so-and-so? Like, what could he do?
Well, what he could do is find a motor carrier that is looking for leased on operators, which is what he's attempting to do here. He's just in the wrong place. Unfortunately, there's not a central clearinghouse. There's not a central dispatch of companies looking to lease people on. So you're at the mercy of the advertisements, the recruiting ads for trucking companies to find a carrier, or word of mouth, talking to people at the auction and finding out if they're leased on to somebody and how they like it, how the experience is going for them. Perhaps it's a program that you could put together through the ATI ecosystem to have a list of carriers that are looking to lease Hotshot and CDL and Stinger and everybody else onto their authority. All I caution is when you do this, both as the driver leasing on and as the motor carrier that's going to take a leased on owner operator, do not enter into it lightly. We were making fun a minute ago. Can I start a trucking company with you? But that's really what you're doing here. This lease is almost like a marriage, and you have to treat it seriously because you, the carrier, become fully legally liable for everything that driver does, even though he owns the truck, including how he maintains or she maintains or fails to maintain that truck. It's all on you. And you as the driver, the owner of that truck that wants to lease on to someone's authority, you have to realize you've given up most of your control over this equipment you own. You can't just decide that you got a good car to move for your buddy on Saturday and throw it on the trailer and go down the road. You can't just decide to take that truck and go grocery shopping or to the dirt track on the Sunday afternoon. It's not yours anymore, as long as that other company's name is on the door and on the lease and responsible for the safety of it. So don't enter into these deals lightly. Make sure you fully understand what you're doing, both as the carrier and as the owner operator that wants to lease on with a company.
We're over 20 minutes in, but good news, guys. We're actually going to go a little longer than usual. Because we have extra stuff, we have questions coming in, and Brian is going to give us extra time today. And actually, that's not his fault. What I mean to say is that we're going to go a little long. That's all I'm trying to let you know. So you still have time. Go ahead and do me a favor. After you leave a like, share this link. Here's why. Right here, MC. Thank you so much. PJK Transport LLC here. Took the week off due to low rates, high diesel prices. New hauler, trying to figure out this game. Self-dispatching. Very little sleep during the weeks I'm hauling. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, best of wishes there. It's a tough game right now for sure.
Here's one. This is a little different. I got an email from a guy. He says, I'd like to find out how is the situation now in the U.S. regarding the recruitment of foreign truck drivers. I once called during the peak times of the pandemic. You advised me to check in with you in case there might be some changes regarding the situation of foreign drivers. Maybe just to refresh your memory, I'm a carrier, hauler, truck driver with more than 10 years experience in the industry. I'm working for one of the biggest car transporting companies in South Africa. I have experience of car carriers from 4 to 12 car cars at a time. So, yeah, I actually do not know what would be advice. He's in South Africa. He's got experience. I guess he wants to come to the USA and work. Any advice?
Currently, we are not taking foreign worker visas for truck drivers. So the workaround to that is you go to Canada on a temporary emergency worker visa, obtain a Canadian version of a commercial driver's license, and then you can do cross-border trucking from Canada into the United States. But currently, U.S. motor carriers are not allowed to hire non-U.S. citizens or resident aliens. So you need to be able to obtain a U.S. CDL, which would mean you would need to get sponsored to come to the country. It's not impossible, but the easy route is to go to Canada instead. But if you can get sponsored to come to the country, establish a residence here, go to United States Trucking School so that you can obtain a U.S. CDL, then you possibly could work here. It's a little more difficult to get a work visa as a truck driver in the U.S. than a engineers are one that they're doing a lot of work visas on right now. So look into the work visa program, but it's very difficult to get one. That said, we are experiencing a lot of churn in the industry in the U.S. So we have plenty of truck drivers. We just don't have many truck drivers that want to stay in the industry. So if you're looking to come and work hard and improve yourself, there may be a place for you here, but it's going to take months to a year or more, and it's going to be very difficult to make it happen. So the easiest way, if you want to come drive in North America, is go to Canada. They are accepting foreign work visa truck drivers.
Brian, you ever get the feeling that somebody might be watching and they're just going crazy at the kind of things that we talk about here? Like, this is so non-traditional. But that's what makes it so important, is that, I don't know, does anybody talk about the clearinghouse on their time off? Except for, hey, I got a letter and I'm being threatened because I didn't do anything. All right, I'm going to keep moving. All right. This isn't for you, Jay, to have fun. Although, I'll tell you what, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go back to share a screen. This is from Matthew Bryant. And he shares information. I want to come back to this, but I love how he's laying out, you know, the expenses, the revenue. Everybody needs to be doing this, right?
Mm-hmm. If this is how you manage your business.
Yes. If you're not doing this, start doing this. Why?
Well, you can't even come close to setting a rate or being able to accept a rate with certainty that you're going to make a profit if you don't know your expenses. And be honest with yourself when you do this. Record every little penny you spend and then look at it and make sure it is truly a business expense. And if it's not, move it off the business ledger onto your personal ledger and adjust the amount of money you send home so that you're not paying for personal expenses out of your business pocket. A, when it comes time to finance that next piece of equipment, it'll put you in a better financial position if the expenses and the money streams are not commingled. B, it'll make an audit, if you ever have a tax audit, a lot simpler if expenses are not commingled, because you're not technically allowed to do that unless you're a sole proprietor. And even if you are a sole proprietor, you still should run two completely separate bank accounts and sets of books, one for your personal life, one for your business. But it also allows you to see a good health, a picture of health of your business, where you are in this industry, and compare it to the rates you're getting versus the rates you think that you need. And you may find out that you can adjust yourself. I never like to adjust down, but you may find out you have to adjust yourself up And then you have the justification for why you're not just arbitrarily saying I need $4 a mile because Jay gets $4 a mile and Ty gets $4 a mile. And so I need $4 a mile. You need, this is a business. You need to know what your expenses are and then price yourself accordingly with a reasonable profit margin, which should probably be 15, 20% or more, and pay yourself a reasonable fair market rate for what you do. And having these numbers will allow you to figure all that out to see if you can even do it. Or do you, I hate to say this this callously, but or did you just create a job for yourself? Or are you in the hobby of hauling cars because you're not really making any money?
Talk about non-traditional. Because it's interesting, when we talk to business owners and they're like, oh, I don't haul anything that pays less than blank. Usually that blank is a high rate on the load board.
Mm-hmm.
But then everyone scrambles. Okay, how'd you do that? Oh, I built business relationships and talked to people. Oh, yeah.
They're absolutely right. The load boards are your low-hanging fruit. They're the easy to obtain work. Now, there's people out there that are cursing me out right now that I have no idea how a load board works, and dealing through the brokers and jumping through their hoops is not easy. It's a lot easier than knocking on doors and building relationships directly with shippers, directly with dealers, directly with the auctions, which is almost impossible. I hate to say it. It's almost impossible today, at least on the auction level, because they're tied up with three or four major players in the country. But the dealerships are not. And trust me when I say you can still get better than a dollar a mile per car freight if you know who to talk to and where to find it. And you don't show up in flip-flops and a ripped t-shirt with a rusted out truck. You have to have that professional appearance. You need to be able to string a few words together and make a complete thought come out of your mouth when you're talking to somebody, and you can do it. And I don't mean to sound arrogant or irritating.
I love it.
But it is true. You need to think of yourself as a businessman, as a salesman. Don't go in and present yourself as the truck driver. And there's nothing wrong with that. Trucking has been a great life for my family. At one time, we had 27 members of my immediate family making their living with a commercial driver's license just a couple years ago. We are truck drivers. But when you're going in to talk to the used car manager or the business manager of a chain of dealerships, they want to talk to a businessman. They don't want to talk to a truck driver. So take off your ball cap, put on your fedora, and become a businessman when you walk in there and speak to them. You're the same guy, the same gal, but it's all in how we hold ourselves and how we present ourselves that'll let you walk out of there with the deal closed instead of the door closed in your face.
And here's the irony is that if you think of your favorite products or your favorite places, they've done all those things.
Mm-hmm.
They brushed up the branding, the people, the message, the product. So why don't we do that in trucking?
I can't help you with that. I don't have that answer. But if you want to see how it's done, and the man is a shrewd, shrewd businessman, but if you want to see how it's done, look in the Ray Kroc. He is known as the founder of the McDonald's restaurant chain.
Oh, man. Although have you seen the movie?
Yes.
The founder? Whoa.
Yes. And he stole that business from the McDonald brothers and then ruthlessly put them out of business when they tried to fight back and start up a new chain.
Man, he put them in a box. Yeah.
Yes.
Go watch The Founder.
Yeah. Go watch it. I'm not saying you want to emulate Ray Kroc.
No.
But the way they built the business, and also follow, I forget the gentleman's name, it escapes me right now, but he was Ray's right-hand man and went over to be the CEO at Burger King in the late 70s or early 80s. And he took Burger King from a nothing to a serious competitor of McDonald's. And you want to know why is Brian talking about fast food hamburgers when we're on a trucking show? Business is hungry. Business.
Yeah.
And you need to think of yourself and what will differentiate you from the competition. There are 30,000 other guys out there with a car hauler. what makes you the special one that they're going to want to do business with time and time again? That is what you need to figure out.
And I'll just finish with this, is that when you're standing on the fuel island and you're bitching about the brokers, they did all the stuff we just said. That's how they got the customer.
Your broker is your salesman for your company. When you can't go do it yourself, you're giving up a percentage of your revenue because you're hiring a salesman. The broker is the one that has to work. They're the one that has the relationship with the customers, and they're not somebody, contrary to popular belief, sitting at home in their pajamas on their laptop, making a bunch of money, pushing a few buttons on the keyboard and making a phone call. Most of these good brokers, the ones that can provide the good quality work, you know, the ones where you don't have the hassle, the car is what it's supposed to be, it's where it's supposed to be, it's ready when you go. Well, those have made all these relationships. Dedicated sales teams to go out and talk to these dealers, and even a dispatcher. And I don't want to get into the broker versus dispatcher, but your dispatcher, if you so choose to hire one in your own company, act as your own, or even use a third-party contracted service, make sure that they come across kind, compassionate, and professional on the phone, that they answer that phone with a smile in their voice, because they are your company when they're dealing with these people. And they're not going to remember Tom the driver, but they're going to remember Jane, the person that was on the phone, because she was nice to them on the phone. So that these are the little things that allow you to grow a business and allow you to one day get out of the seat if you want to and have several trucks in an office, or even allow you to have a stress-free life behind the wheel as much as that's possible, just because you have all this set and you're not worried where your next penny is going to come from, because you know that you can count on these direct customers.
Silvermint was asking if I remembered the question from last week, so we're going to try to go to it. A question about the DOT combining gross vehicle weight with actual weight to produce the highest value. Do you remember that question?
I remember part of the question. I believe that they had been placed out of service because the weight ratings on their truck were over the CDL threshold. So is Silverman asking for more clarification on that, or what's the deal?
Yeah. And I'm asking the same thing. And I think Silverman is, I'm going to guess, speaking into the text so that it's doing the autocorrect. And we're not getting... So do me try another stab at it, Silverman, and then we will get to it. Because we're going to be here. We're probably going to stay for another 20-plus minutes. Mm-hmm. We still have several news stories to get to. Ants Transportation. Can a Canadian driver work under a U.S. trucking company as an owner-operator? Good question.
Can a Canadian owner-operator work under a U.S. trucking company?
Yeah, I'm going to ask it again, but I think that's right. Can a Canadian driver work under a U.S. trucking company as an owner-operator?
That's a great question that we're going to have the stumper, because I don't want to say it wrong, and I don't know for sure. I know that Canadian companies hire U.S.-based drivers, especially out of Arizona, to run cross-border freight. And I have seen Canadian motor carriers contract with U.S. owner-operators, but I don't know if it works both ways. These rules are kind of crazy and unique, and with the new United States-Mexico-Canada agreement that replaced the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, some of the minute details have changed. So I can't answer that one right now, but I'll find an answer and put it in the notes on this one later after it's been uploaded.
And then once you do that, go ahead and clarify and explain how the ELD works when you're going from U.S. to Canada and Canada and back.
Oh, that one's not that difficult. since Canada requires ELDs now, and they're up to 6 that are acceptable and certified by the Canadian government to function in Canada. Right now they have a soft enforcement period in Canada. So not counting that, you just, when you cross the border, your ELD will have a button you push to change to Canadian hours and Canadian rules, and you run on the Canadian rules while you're in Canada, the United States rules when you're in the U.S. Now, once they start hard enforcing the Canadian ELD mandate, you will have to have one that has been independently certified by a testing lab that the Canadian government has chosen. The difference between their ELD and the United States version is the U.S. allows us to self-certify that it meets all the standards, whereas Canada required an independent lab to run these ELDs through a battery of tests to make sure that they're hack-proof, fraud-proof, and do what they say they're supposed to do. But right now, you can still cross the border with any ELD as long as it has a Canadian function, so it knows you're across the Canadian border and tracks the added information they require, such as license plate and odometer readings. And also, it fully allows you to take advantage of the Canadian hours of service, which, while you're in Canada, you're allowed to use their extended hours as long as you're back in compliance with U.S. rules once you cross south of the border back into the United States.
The only real downside is that to keep it operating, as soon as you cross the border, you switch from inserting U.S. quarters into the machine, and then you need Canadian quarters. You have to stop and get Canadian quarters so you can keep your ELD running like an old 70s parking meter. Okay, Jay. So now, let's go to... this is a really good one. Okay, first 24 hours after a crash can affect legal implications later. Kind of relevant for today's show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, so let's talk. I know, again, this is, man, camera one. This is the boring stuff nobody wants to talk about. The problem is, now that you're married to a new company you started, you got to know all this stuff. So let's talk about it, Brian. What's going on here?
Absolutely. And how you respond to a crash can protect your house, your bank account, your life savings, and everything. Because remember, even if you are incorporated or are an LLC, if you're operating the business day to day, they can pierce those legal protections and come after your personal assets. Again, I am not a practicing attorney and seek legal advice from your own attorneys. However, I have seen this happen more times than I can count, where the owner of the trucking company also happens to be the driver involved in the crash, and so they go after him personally as well as the business asset. So the first 24 hours after a crash, the first minute after a crash is critical to the outcome. Obviously, we have to make sure everybody is safe first, but you need to never admit fault, even if you know you're at fault, never admit it. And admitting fault can be something as simple as saying, and as courteous as saying, "I'm sorry this happened," or something of those lines. So we want to avoid that. And like you highlighted on the screen right now, a driver can be overwhelmed or scared. And if someone's injured, it's traumatic for everyone involved. And they have some great information in here. And yes, provided you work for a company, your first call should be to somebody from your company, whoever handles your safety and compliance, your dispatcher, someone that'll know what to do. But we deal mostly with owner operators, so you are the person that needs to understand what to do. And first and foremost, check on the injured, but only render aid if you're qualified to do so. You don't want to make the injuries any worse. Have somebody else, if there's extra people on scene, call 911. That way you can focus on what is going on and protecting the scene and protecting the people. So we want to get the injuries taken care of, never admit fault, and then you want to document what happened with your cell phone camera. You can't take too many pictures. Take as many as you can, close up, far away, damage the injured people that get out of the car, because with trucking having deep pockets with our federal required insurance of $750 to $1 million or more, you'll be surprised when you had an accident and there was one person in the car, and then you get the lawsuit 2 years later, and there's three or four named parties that were injured, and you have no proof that there was only one person in the car. So your reactions there are important. Even if you're a non-CDL where a drug test is not required, I strongly suggest you submit to a drug and alcohol test to prove that you were clear. That way they can't cast a shadow of doubt against your sobriety, your competency when you were, if it does go to trial, because that's what'll happen. Personal injury lawyers, they practice reptile law. They throw everything at it. They make us look like we are awful prehistoric monsters, and they throw everything at it and see what sticks. And they will flat out make the implication that you could have been drunk or drugged. And well, they didn't take a drug test, so what were they hiding, even when it may not have been required? So stuff like that will really help you in an accident.
In fact, what's the I can't think of what's Brandon's company, and he's got like a post-accident crash checklist. Gosh, I can't think of it.
It's escaping me right now.
Right? So. We'll come up. We'll think of that. But really good stuff, Brian. Great advice. And reptile law. You didn't even make up reptile law. That's a real thing.
It is.
It's a real thing.
Reptile theory is.
The reptile theory. Okay, speaking of. So let's go into CBD oil. But, Your Honor, so this one. Federal court allowing a trucker to proceed with a lawsuit accusing a CBD oil company of costing him his job after testing positive for THC. Isn't that interesting?
I find it interesting that the federal court is allowing this lawsuit to proceed. First off, the disclaimer, I don't care. I don't have a stance one way or the other on marijuana or CBD products.
Why are you taking CBD oil? You're taking CBD oil because you're looking for THC under a different name.
Okay, yes.
Allegedly. And I'm not saying I don't understand. I get it.
I get it. That I don't have a personal opinion on the product, good, bad, or indifferent. But we have to remember, regardless of your state law and whether you have the right in your state to use it recreationally or medicinally, even with a prescription, it's still a federally prohibited substance. And since it is not an FDA regulated substance, the Food and Drug Administration has set no standards for what the manufacturers can claim as zero THC on these oils and other products that are sold over the counter in truck stops and convenience stores and everywhere else that you can get fine products. So you can't trust, and are you willing to bet your entire career on that product set being truly zero THC? Because maybe it's 0.04% and they rounded down to zero. Well, 0.04% will show up on a drug screen, and you have no legitimate way under the current federal regulations to explain the presence of THC or in your system. It's a falsity that enough poppy seeds on a bagel will give you a positive drug test. That is a falsity.
It is. So let's keep going, because I got more on this, but I just want to say that, I mean, this is the what sucks so bad about all this is that, so I think there's still so many people that think of trucking as, it's still a frontier. I can be an entrepreneur. I like to drive, and I can build my own business, and I can do what I want, and F the man. But it's anything but.
We are one of the most highly regulated industries in the United States. And as an industry that is designated as highly regulated, we automatically give up a lot of rights that you would have if you worked in any other industry. If you were working in retail and you test positive for marijuana and lost your job, lost your career, you might have a wrongful termination suit depending upon the state you're in. In trucking, you're branded a criminal and a drug addict, and you have to undergo a very invasive, expensive return to duty process that includes psychological evaluation and direct observation drug test for a year. And even then, the mark stays on your record for 5 years afterwards. So I'm interested to see what the outcome of the case is, where the federal court's allowing it to proceed, because I think they're trying to sue that manufacturer under truth in labeling regulations. But I'm really surprised the federal court's allowing it to happen, because this is still an illegal substance in the eyes of the federal government. So I'm surprised they're letting their court system rule on something. And so on to what's on the screen now.
Look at this. Well, I just want to say, there's a shortage of plastic cups and lab technicians. Drivers are like, yeah, it's about time. Well, I can't get tested.
Nope. I'm glad you brought this up today, Jay, because this is one of the topics I wanted to speak on. Even though there's a shortage of supplies and staff to conduct your test, we are not relieved from any of the compliance measures. And this is critically important here for those of you with a CDL that are in a random drug testing program and have been notified to report to a specific testing location, a collection site. If you get there and for some reason, they cannot collect your specimen and send it to the lab, I don't care if they tell you our only certified technician is off today, they called in sick, or we just used our last plastic cup, or whatever the reason is. You cannot legally even walk back out of the door of that office until you have contacted your consortium or whoever ordered the drug test for you, which for an owner operator will be a third party administrator consortium. For a company driver, it will be your drug testing program administrator at your company. But you cannot even walk physically back out their door, because that can be reported and has been, this is why this article exists, has been reported as a refusal to test, which is considered the same as a positive test. And there is no undoing a refusal to test. There is no challenging it. There is the Part 40 of the federal drug testing regulations is very clear. There is no legal process to challenge a positive drug test besides the split specimen. And if they test that and that's positive too, well, then the result stays. So listen to me closely. If you get to the testing site and for any reason they cannot do your test, right there from that counter, you need to call your drug testing company and they have to find you another location. And I don't care if it's 100 miles away, you have to directly, immediately report to that location and produce your sample, or you will have a failure to test recorded. And with the federal clearinghouse, you will not be allowed to drive. And with the new rules that go into effect shortly, the federal clearinghouse will have to let the state know that you have a positive drug test, and your CDL will be downgraded. And so then you won't even be able to drive under the table for somebody that doesn't check drug testing, because you will not have a CDL anymore. And yes, it's ridiculous. It's an overreach of power to give you a positive mark and ruin your career because the company that's supposed to have someone there to collect your sample did not. But that is the facts of the matter today. And until they give us some relief, this is the reality we face. So it's always important to make sure that when you are managing the company, you don't send a driver for a drug test. You've called that testing location and don't notify the driver of their drug test until you've called that testing location, made sure they have a properly certified technician, have the specimen cups, the ability to collect the sample in the time frame your driver is going to be there. There is no leeway on this.
The pendulum has swung, and that's why the next time you catch yourself quoting scripture and verse about a law, the pendulum can swing back to you as well. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, I certainly, knowing how bad this stuff has gotten, I would probably think twice about starting a trucking company. Unless I just freaking love trucking. Because, I mean, they're just all up in your business about everything. You got to really love trucking now.
It is very difficult. But that said, there are thousands of new authority applications processed each month in the United States. It is up at record levels of companies starting trucking companies. And not all of the market is depressed. There are some segments that are having stellar growth and record years right now. Now, there are some issues we have to deal with, such as shortage of vehicles and parts and technicians to maintain those vehicles, but it's not all doom and gloom. But do your research. Don't go out and invest $100,000 or more because somebody at the fuel island told you that they were making $10,000 a week, or you got that ad it popped up in your text message that we can dispatch you and guarantee you $7,000 a week. All you need is a pickup truck. Don't go out on that.
Well, what happens when, because I'm seeing it in the live chat, I'm going to go to these questions in a second. What happens when the clearinghouse, and some of what I don't like is that, you know, there's like this giddiness about, you know, catching everybody for everything at any time, anywhere. Well, what happens when they go after non-CDL? Will that happen? Are we?
We're years away from that happening. That said, there has been talk. There has not been an official notice of proposed rulemaking yet, but there has been talk, and there is support from the law enforcement and regulatory community to require drug testing for any commercial vehicle operations, which, remember, a commercial vehicle in federal terms is anything 10,001 pounds gross weight rating or more. So that would take your F-250 or 350 pickup truck and require drug testing if you're using it for business purpose. I don't know if that will ever come to fruition, but there has been serious consideration of it. And then we will have if we think we have a labor shortage now.
Well, that will be, I mean, that would be an atom bomb onto the whole truck, the whole idea of just, yeah, jump in a truck. Who said it? Chris says it. It's not just truck and trailer and go get them, which we see all the time. Just yes. Go get them. There's all these videos. That's why I named it Ye Old Hot Shot and Hustle.
And folks, I am not taking and trying to squash anybody's dream. I started myself with one little truck. It was not a pickup truck, but it was a non-CDL two-car carrier rollback. My former business partner started with a F-450 and a three-car Kaufman trailer. And together we built quite an empire. And it can be done. All we ask is you do it safely and legally. And so don't use the hot shot as your way around complying because you can't pass a drug test. So that's all we ask is, if you're going to do it seriously and do it properly.
And that's it. If you also think you're going to be F the man trucking, you got the wrong decade.
Oh yeah, that stuff went out the window in the late 70s. This is not convoy. We are not out here blowing the scales and saying who cares. Today's day and age, trucking is highly regulated and enforcement does a great job of catching even the most minor of violations. Some may say that they're overzealous, and I say to an extent some of them can be. But they're charged with safety. It may seem like revenue generation, but they are charged with the safety of the highway. And the problem are the rules that they have to enforce, not what they're doing. So we need better regulations that actually pertain more to safety than revenue generation. And we might see a huge improvement. But just for example, CVSA just released the results of brake check. And they found over 5,000 chafed brake lines during their inspection. They inspected 37,000 and change vehicles. And they found over 5,000 of them with brake lines chafed to the point that they were considered defective. Now, that's an area that some people have a problem with because I have seen some overzealous enforcement there. But they also found thousands of vehicles with missing brake components, like a brake can that fell off or brake shoe that fell out of the drum, push rods that are disconnected. These are the people who are out on the road with us. One in five commercial motor vehicles has a brake defect on it today. That's what the studies show when they do these surprise inspection blitzes. So look around you, your truck, and look at the four trucks around you as you're driving down the road. One of those five has an out-of-service condition on their braking system. Do you want to be the guy that's behind them and hope that they're going to be able to stop? So there is a need for compliance and enforcement. It just has to be done like everything else within reason.
So here's Silverman with clarification back on the keyboard. Between GVWRs and GVW, when can a DOT apply this statement or any combination thereof that produces the highest value? Can DOT combine GVWR and actual weight to produce a violation?
No. They can either take your physical weights, and if your physical weights exceed the threshold for CDL, so if your physical weights exceed 26,001 pounds and they can prove that at least 10,000 of that is on the trailer, then they can do that, or they can combine the gross vehicle weight ratings of the truck and trailer. And even if, in that case, even if you're physically below 26,000 pounds, but the weight ratings exceed it, then it is still a violation. But no, they can't say, well, the pickup truck says 14, the trailer says 12, that's 26 even, but the trailer has 13,000 pounds on it. But overall, we're only weighing 25,000. We're going to write them a no CDL violation. They can't mix between the two categories. The combination, the phrase or any combination thereof that produces the highest numeric value is either rating or actual weight.
David says he'd rather be behind a guy with bad brakes than in front of him.
I would agree.
And let's see here. Oh, also, Chris really appreciates the analogy with the burger business. And what's interesting, he points out that when someone said to Ray, so what do you think you do? And he said, I'm in the real estate business, right? Man, that was a great moment in that movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about that, too. Let's apply this to the guys that want to be lease operators. They want to own their own business, but they don't want to do all the back office and all the overhead. You can compare that to the franchise model where you go and buy a Burger King or a McDonald's. They teach you how to run it. They give you the policy manual, tell you exactly what to do, feed you the product, market it for you, but it's still up to you to make the profit. So if you look at your leased on driver the same way, when you're leasing on to a motor carrier, they're there to support you, but it's still up to you to run your part of the operation as efficiently, safely, and effectively as possible. It really is the same concept.
Well, and that's why I go so far as to say, so if you've done that, started your own business, built your own franchise, you've got all the manuals, all the training, etc., but now to bring in customers, you're going to rely on your dispatcher, in this case, the cashier. What are you talking about?
Well, your cashier, when we have a rude experience at the counter, we complain about that restaurant, about that particular McDonald's location. Well, your dispatcher is the cashier. The driver is the cook that delivers the product. It's all the same concept.
Amazing how that works. Also, MC says, I'm non-CDL owner-operator for my company and mandate DOT physical on my records files as well as random drug testing. Question, is the clearinghouse just for CDL drivers? I know that one.
Correct. It is only CDL. You do not have a reporting or a querying obligation for non-CDL drivers. Even if you hire a driver that physically has a commercial driver's license, if they're only operating non-CDL equipment, there is no drug testing or clearinghouse reporting requirements.
Really appreciate the question. Want to say, okay, so we're at 1 o'clock. We never do this. We're going to go a little bit longer and try and finish everything up. It's really important stuff. right? You know this if you found out the hard way. And so we're trying to help you avoid finding out the hard way. Join us here on DOT Compliance every Wednesday. Let's go to the next slide. Just finishing up this. So FMCSA tells states to ban drivers with drug and alcohol strikes. We've kind of covered this one in the past, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're locking up all the loopholes, right?
Oh, absolutely. The intent of the clearinghouse was to catch the driver that worked for the big motor carrier and took his 2-week vacation to go apply at the next company, failed his pre-employment drug test, and then went back to his current employer like nothing ever happened. And the current employer has no idea that there was a failed drug test out there. Then when they can test clean and they leave for another employer, they just fail to mention the employer that they applied at and failed the pre-employment drug test. That's the whole purpose of this clearinghouse. And now the requirement for the clearinghouse and the states to suspend or revoke your CDL for drug violations is a way to force the people with a drug problem to get help that they need and keep them off the roads until a time that they have been rehabilitated and can be clean and sober and operate a truck. It's not to ruin anybody's career. It's not to put anybody out of work. It's so that you can get the help that you need.
If you're just joining us, do me a favor, Brian. Switch that mic input source. I think a battery may have just died on us. We'll see. But while Brian is doing that, what we're doing here is we're doing an extra long edition of DOT Compliance on a Wednesday because we had a couple that we didn't get to in the past. And so I've got a couple extra news stories. While Brian is switching that out, I'm going to bring up the next news story. Let's see here. And I think it's check. I think I hear you.
All right.
Yeah, I'm a little bit loud. Check, mic check. Okay, check. Okay, here we go. All right, cool. Thank you, Brian. Now, I'm going to get off the clearinghouse stuff because I know. So how about overnight parking at state rest areas? What is going on here, dude?
Oh, you got to love this. Federal money pays to build these rest areas. And then the states decide that they can't afford to maintain them, or the states have nuisance laws. I love thinking of ourselves as nuisances that limit the amount of time you can spend in the rest area. And quite a few states have less than 10 hours, because 10 would be what you need to take a federally required rest break. But quite a few states have less than 10 hours you can spend there. Some have as little as 15 minutes if you're sleeping. They literally only allow you to take a nap, whereas others have it posted that you're not allowed to be there, but then say, oh, that doesn't apply to trucks. But in the letter of the law, it does. So this is something I really love when they dig into this stuff at Landline, and they dig in deep and good, and they do a very good job covering it. And this is something they've covered very well. Bottom line, we don't have anywhere to park our trucks, and you can't even count on the rest areas to be allowable for parking your truck. You could end up with a citation for violating state law for staying overnight in a rest area. It's crazy. It's ridiculous. It should not be allowed to happen.
I'm telling you, you've got to freaking love trucking to get in. I mean, man, you have to love it. I mean, live it, love it.
They say it's a lifestyle, Jay.
It's more than a lifestyle. It is. It's a new marriage. Let's see here. Wearable device monitors mariners' fatigue. Do we? It says it was developed for truckers and heavy equipment operators. Do we have smart cap wearable bands to detect fatigue in truckers yet?
They're not required yet. There are a couple of companies that have been experimenting with fatigue monitoring, including a large dash cam manufacturer and a large truck OEM that have partnered together to put fatigue monitors in the trucks. They're all voluntary right now to see if it can catch you when you're tired. In a way, I like this concept. because this is the way the airlines manage their hours of service. Their hours of service are very complex, but it's based on time of day you started work, time of day you'll be flying, when you ended, how many cycles you've had in a row, and all on and on. If we could actually come up with a fatigue monitor-based hours of service system, then we wouldn't have these arbitrary 10 and 14 hour rules that make some people sleep or attempt to sleep when they're not really tired, nor would we have people trying to push through. There was a tow truck operator that was damn near killed the other day because someone in an RV was trying to push through the overnight to get where they wanted to go, fell asleep and hit the truck and hit the tow truck that was working on the side of the road.
Wow.
We really should not be driving fatigued, and fatigue is different. When I was younger, I could work literally 3 days in a row and still feel perfectly fine. Now, 10 or 11 hours behind the wheel, and I'm starting to get tired and looking for that place to pull over and go to sleep. So fatigue is something that is unique to each individual, and I welcome some studies on this so that we can actually get some real science on how the human body behaves and how our skills degrade throughout the day as we get tired.
I'm quite sure that we're on this quest to get people out of vehicles, or at least behind the wheel. Story after story. And I know that's horrible. I'm in the wrong place to say this.
You're right, but we're still decades from the technology actually being there to allow that to happen. I just attended a connected vehicle and automated vehicle forum, and the engineers from Virginia Tech Transportation, Virginia Tech University Transportation Department. They still claim that we are probably 2 to 3 decades from level 5 autonomy in motor vehicles. Currently, we have level 2, and level 3 is being experimented with, but the people are not even out of the vehicle until it's level 4. We have a handful of almost level 4 vehicles that are being used on very dedicated closed loop systems, such as in Arizona with the Waymo taxi car.
Texas.
Yes.
China.
Yes.
I said the C word. But, okay, so 2 to 3 decades. That's really interesting.
Yes. Now, over the next 2 to 3 decades, we're going to see the driver's role drastically change from physically being the one that handles the truck all the time to being the one that's just there to babysit the automated systems and do the very difficult, which I'm wondering how that's going to work. Because when they study this automation in airline pilots, they find that when an emergency happens, the pilots are rusty. The pilots get tired easier during the day when they're just babysitting the computer. And the most critical time in an airplane is takeoff and landing. And that's when the pilots need to still have those hard skills, but they don't develop the hard, or maintain the hard skills and the muscle memory necessary to do their job when they count on the computer. Automation in the airline industry today can take off and land the plane without pilot input at all. And a lot of airlines allow their pilots to do that. So next time you're on an airplane, which I'm on several times a week, think about it. It may be a computer flying, not the actual human being sitting in the cockpit. And that's where they're going with trucking, is the humans will be there to monitor the load, monitor the vehicle, and correct for the anomalies that the computer can't figure out on its own. And that's what's going to happen.
This just popped in my head, but I think, you know how you keep them from getting rusty?
How do you do that?
Video games.
Well, you know what? You're being serious. I know you're being funny, but being serious, that's exactly what the airline industry is doing with flight simulators. I have several pilots that are friends, and some of them have very elaborate $10,000 flight simulator setups, nothing compared to the multi-million dollar ones that their companies have, but they have them at home. And you would think they'd get enough time playing in the airplane as a pilot, but no, they sit at home and practice their skills on the flight simulator. And there's a major trucking company in the United States, Schneider, who used to have a very good training academy, contrary to public opinion, that included simulators, a skid pad, and they would put you through all these emergency situations long before you ever drove a truck on the road. And you would master the simulator, including how to shift gears. They had a computer that taught you how to shift the manual transmission. And if you missed a gear, it would grind and fight back with your hand. And the technology is there for us to practice and hone our skills. Because what they're expecting in the transition to automated vehicles is more and more driver assist features, then being able to convoy a couple of trucks with one human being, then eventually having like drone pilots in the military, drone operators, where you're sitting in your house in your back bedroom working from home with the layout of the truck in front of you, and you're responsible for physically operating up to 5 or 10 actual vehicles anywhere in the world at any given time. That's the progression that they see this going in.
It's pretty wild stuff. Right now, somebody's like, man, I didn't get any drama and I didn't make any money listening to you guys for an hour. Chris does ask, hey, Brian, is insurance different with a two-car flatbed compared to car hauling trailers?
Potentially, yes. The type of vehicle plays into what your insurance premium is. The area that you're going to operate in plays into it. With a two-car flatbed, you have to be careful. A lot of your insurance agents will write it like a tow truck, and they'll write you on hook liability for the vehicles that you're hauling, which is not cargo. So your brokers are not going to accept it in most cases. Or they'll figure if you're running a two car carrier, you're hauling salvage, and they'll insure you differently. So you can insure a tow truck a lot less expensively than you can insure a car hauler. Even when you're hauling the same physical value of vehicles, two vehicles on a two-car trailer or two vehicles on a rollback tow truck. So just make sure that your insurance agent fully understands your business so that they're comparing apples to apples when they write it. But yes, that insurance probably is a little less expensive than a pickup truck and a trailer because the type of vehicle plays into the risk when they're rating it as well.
Let's see. Do I have it? I think that's it for the news. Okay, here we go. Now, here's what we're going to do. You got a preview. We are going to do, for the first time ever, we're going to do 3 Are You a Car Shipping Guru Larry questions on DOT compliance. These have to do with DOT compliance. If you've never heard of this game before, this is something we do on Tuesday nights, and then we do the answers on Thursdays on Dispatching Live. But this is the first ever Are You a Car Shipping Guru questions on DOT compliance. Let me double check my audio before I get forward here. Mic check, 1, 2, 3. You can hear me okay? Yeah, the audio changes. I don't know why. I was just sitting here. All right, here we go. Now it's too loud. All right, mic check, 1, 2, 3. Here we go. You are at risk of an hour's violation when driving more than 60 hours in 7 days or blank hours in 8 days. Is it 62, 65, 68, or 70? Now, Brian knows the answer, so he's going to be delayed on the answer, but this is your opportunity in the live chat. Is it 62, 65, 68, or 70? Going once. At risk of an hour's violation when driving more than 60 hours in 7 days or blank hours in 8 days. All right, here we go. Brian, what is the answer?
70. You have 2 clocks that you count. Your 60 hours in 7 days or your 70 hours in 8 days. And it depends on whether your motor carrier operates commercial vehicles all 7 days of the week, which allows you to use the 70 in 8 days, or if you do not operate trucks regularly all 7 days of the week, you are capped at no more than 60 hours in 7 days.
Follow-up question, does the DOT expect you to know this stuff cold?
Yes.
Okay, there you
go. That's why part of your driver qualification file is the statement page from the front of that little green book that nobody's ever read. It explains part 300 to 399. You're expected to know every word of all 800 and some pages of that section. It's impractical. It's impossible. If you go back to when I started driving a truck, you had to take a general knowledge test every time you were hired to prove you knew at least the basics of these rules before your employer could put you behind the wheel of a truck. And that had to stay on your file. They stopped doing that several years ago, maybe 20. But you used to have to actually take a quiz on this stuff.
Okay, question two. A driver exempt from e-logs, but not current on a paper log going back more than blank days can be considered as having no logbook and be put out of service. Is it 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, or 4 days that you need to be able to go back on a paper log if you're e-log exempt? If you're on the podcast, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. You can't guess because you're on the podcast and it's after the fact. But if you're in the live chat, 1, 2, 3, or 4, and I know, this is the kind of stuff. See, on Tuesday nights, we can just have fun. But here, it's serious, right? This is where it gets pretty real. All right, Brian, what is the answer to this?
We
got a stumper.
No,
okay.
The way the question is worded makes this one confusing.
Ah.
Because a driver exempt from e-logs.
That's what I was thinking.
But not current on a paper log going back more than blank days can be considered as having no logbook and put out of service.
If you're exempt from e-logs, do you need a paper log?
There's a couple of ways to answer this. That's where I was going with this, yeah. Jay. If you're exempt from e-logs and you're operating within the short haul exemption to be exempt from e-logs, then you need no documentation of hours of service with you until you're aware that you no longer qualify for the short haul exemption, meaning you have exceeded the 150 air mile radius, or you know your day is going to be longer than 14 hours, or you're not going to be able to return back to your normal work reporting location. So in that case, the regulation says you have to start a log immediately as soon as the driver becomes aware they no longer will qualify for the short haul exemption. They need to recreate it back to midnight of that night and continue on a paper log until such time as they qualify for the short haul exemption. So the only other way to be exempt from an ELD would be if your vehicle is model year 2000 or older, or engine model year 2000 or older. And in that case, then you would have to follow all the same rules with your paper log as if you had an ELD or the short haul exemption. So the way this question is worded, the answer could be either one or two.
And because I'm going to ask what I was thinking it said, is that if your e-log breaks, if you run out of Canadian quarters,
mm-hmm.
right, and now you're on paper, how many days do they expect you to be able to go back on paper?
Well, if your e-log breaks, if that's what the intent of this question is, then the answer is 7 plus the current day, which would be 8. Which is why we're required to carry 7 or 8 blank log sheets with us when you have an ELD. So it depends on what the intent of this question was. The answer can be 1 or it can be 8.
And so David he's on track with the 7 as far as the 7 days that you're talking about, which is interesting to know. The amendment here is it's 8 because you have to have 7 plus 1.
Correct.
But this is really good stuff. I'm really glad. I'm liking this a lot. This is interesting, right?
Yes. Superflow is not going to like it because we're picking apart their promotional question.
Well, the thing is, and here's the problem, is putting these questions together to go up against an expert live, man, talk about pressure.
I'll keep Larry the Llama on his toes.
And here the answer. Okay, the answer on this, we're going to move on. Here we go.
Well, I on this one, the way it was worded, if we're talking about short haul, 2 would be a correct acceptable answer. If we're talking just about an ELD failure, then the number is 8.
It's crazy, man. All right, here we go. Believe me, we've had this happen on Tuesday night. We've had occasional. All right, here we go. It happens. Payload can be calculated by subtracting blank from GCVWR. Loaded weight, vehicle length, curb weight, ultimate weight. How we doing? Payload can be calculated. Yeah.
Easy enough.
Okay. Payload can be calculated by subtracting blank from GCVWR. That would be, I'm gonna guess. I'm speculating live. I'm gonna go with loaded weight.
You haven't been paying attention as I explain this nearly weekly.
Right. No, actually that doesn't make sense because I'm thinking payload. So I'm wrong. This is why I don't drive, load, or have any.
Again, this one, it's going to depend upon the specific language.
I just booed myself.
This is going to depend upon the specific language that Larry speaks. The technical word I would say is curb weight, because curb weight is another way of saying you're unladen, or the actual weight of the vehicle with its fluids in it, but no cargo. So that, from your gross combined vehicle weight rating, would tell you how much is left over to haul your payload.
There it is. Thank you so much, Brian. And if there's any questions on that, yeah, put it in the live chat. You know how to contact Brian. Send it to onair@yourdotguy.com. Put that in there. Email your question. You can send me the news, autotransportintel@gmail.com. Follow the podcast. We've kept Brian long enough. We covered everything, and that's what I'm really excited about. Brian, thank you so much for taking the time. This is the longest DOT compliance we've ever had.
Well, thank you, Jay. I'm happy to be here and happy to answer the questions. Glad to be here for everybody.
So we want to thank everybody that was in the live chat. If you listen live or on demand, thank you so much for doing so. Brian, we will see you again. Let me check the calendar here. Yes, we have another show again next Wednesday. Oh, and by the way, you know what's going on next Wednesday? Owida is having their Truck to Success event.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to catch up with them if I get a chance. I know they stay pretty busy, so I don't know if that'll happen or not. In November, we have some trade shows happening in November, so we'll see what happens there.
The 10th of November, the second Wednesday in November, I know that I will likely be unavailable because I have a big trade show in Baltimore for the towing industry. Now, it's not exclusive towing industry. Car haulers are more than welcome. The Independent Automobile Transporters Alliance will even have a booth there, so you can come down and meet John and Derek and Ziggy and the crew from IATA. They'll have a booth there. We'll have an insurance agent there for help on some insurance, and I will be there speaking and presenting.
Awesome. And we also will have no DOT the week after that, because I'll be in Vegas at Used Car Week.
All right. So we've got two more shows in a row. Yeah, the 27th and the 3rd. Then we'll have two off, and we'll be back on November 24th, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
Oh, the turkey episode.
Yes. We'll start dropping turkeys out of a helicopter.
Exactly. We'll be comparing trucking to running a turkey business.
I'll be your reporter live on the scene.
Ooh,
this is
fantastic.
Les Nessman.
WKRP in Cincinnati. All right, Brian. Listen, man, thank you so much for a great episode. We really appreciate you. Stay safe out there and keep us posted, okay?
You're welcome. Take care, everybody.
All right. See you, Brian. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. And I let Brian go. That's it. And everybody, you know that you can send in. Do me a favor. Go ahead and send in your questions. autotransportintel@gmail.com. If you want to reach Brian, it's right there on air at yourdotguy.com. And that way you can get an answer quickly. If you need to reach Brian, email him there. Because that's what happens, right? These problems, the really big problems, come sudden and you need quick help. So contact Brian, let him know how he can help you. Thanks for watching Auto Transport Intel. This was the longest DOT compliance episode we've ever had. Tomorrow, we have a 90-minute Dispatching Live episode starting at noon. We're going to do the answers from Tuesday night's questions. Dealers acquiring inventory is what we just did last night. That was a great show. But on Dispatching Live, we're going to dive into load boards. What's going on with Cars Arrive load board? Find out. Join us tomorrow on Dispatching Live. Take care, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you.